Pacifica Radio. This is Democracy Now! They're being called the Pentagon Papers of the 1990s, the Cigarette Papers, a collection of top-secret documents that show how the tobacco industry tried to deceive the American public about the dangers of smoking. Dr. Glantz, do you think that tobacco industry executives should be put in jail?
Yes.
For how long?
Well, I mean, they're mass murderers. I mean, the tobacco industry kills about 420,000 smokers and about 50,000 non-smokers a year. I think they've been guilty of the grossest kinds of misrepresentations to the public, to the courts, to the Congress, and they ought to be held accountable.
Dr. Stanton Glantz, the man who dared to release the cigarette papers, will talk about the science and politics of tobacco. Coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! This is Pacifica, Radio with Vision, the program Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The White House reacted angrily when the maker of a controversial negative campaign ad asked a federal judge to release President Clinton's videotaped testimony in the trial of his former Whitewater partners. Floyd Brown, chair of the conservative group Citizens United, says Bill Clinton's attempt to keep his testimony in the Whitewater trial from being publicly aired shows he's absolutely paranoid about his testimony. He goes on, if he and Hillary did absolutely nothing wrong in regards to Whitewater, why can't the American people watch him say so under oath? A transcript of Clinton's testimony was released last week when jurors in Arkansas heard about it, but presidential aides want the videotape kept under wraps to prevent Republicans from using it in television ads this election year. But Brown's not the only one who wants to get a copy of the tape. Several major television networks have asked a federal appeals court to order immediate release of the tape. And President Clinton says he opposes same-sex marriages, this according to the White House, and he may sign a bill to outlaw the practice. Press Secretary Mike McCurry says he believes this is a time when we need to do things to strengthen the American family, and that's the reason why he's taken this position. The bill would make the definition of marriage as only a legal union between one man and one woman a part of federal law. Spouse would also be legally limited to a person of the opposite sex. Senator Bob Dole backed the bill last week, given pressures on Clinton and the Senate Majority Leader to highlight their family values. It is believed the president would sign the measure if it passes Congress. The president is on record since 1992 opposing same-sex marriages. Gay rights groups, an important political bloc for the Democrat, long ago agreed to disagree with Clinton on the matter. But the activists are already lobbying him to block the Dole-backed bill. As one person from the Human Rights Campaign said, we fully expect the president will not sign this bill and he will see it for what it is, an election year trap. She went on, he can take a principled stand on this point and point out this is unnecessary and gratuitous gay bashing. Are proposals to provide free television time to presidential candidates in conflict with equal access rules? The Federal Communications Commission is reviewing whether its regulations inhibit plans to enhance political debate. At issue is whether the free time proposals should be considered news programs and therefore exempt from requirements under the Federal Communications Act and FCC rules that grant equal time to all candidates. If not, third-party candidates could demand equal access to the airwaves. In theory, the rules guarantee time to all candidates in a campaign if one is granted free time. Exemptions are made for newscasts, interview programs, and debate coverage. Paul Taylor is the driving force behind the Free TV for Straight Talk Coalition. He says that when that law was adopted, the Communications Act recognized that there's a difference between major candidates and fringe candidates, and that major candidates tend to be more newsworthy. The issue comes up every 4 years during presidential debates. Strict criteria limit participation to major candidates, or that's what they call them. Significant third-party candidates such as Ross Perot have been included, but every year several other candidates are excluded. And Ross Perot's Texas supporters filed petitions bearing about 160,000 signatures with the Secretary of State's office late yesterday, likely reaching their goal of getting an independent presidential candidate on the November ballot. This news from West Virginia. It's Jay Rockefeller versus the janitor in West Virginia's Democratic Senate primary today, while a man who was once the state's youngest governor attempts a comeback that would make him the oldest. Rockefeller, who spent a record $12 million of his own money in winning his first term in 1984, faced only one primary challenger, Bruce Barilla. The part-time Church of Christ minister earns about $13,000 a year working at tiny Concord College in the Appalachian town of Athens. Rockefeller, who recently was instrumental in landing a 300-job Toyota Motor Corporation engine plant for the state, is expected to win the nomination easily. Barilla works the night shift and owns only one suit. He said, "With God, all things are possible. On the other hand, I could get clobbered." And as we move into our first segment of the show today, we're going to take a look at cigarettes. There's a new ad campaign out from R.J. Reynolds as they put out a number of new cigarettes with all sorts of unusual names, like, for example, Politics. It's highlighted in this month's issue of George magazine, Politics. That's Politics spelled with an X. And it says that among its seven kinds of new cigarettes, there's one called Politics. Smoking has become so politicized, we're playing on that idea, explains Moonlight executive Dirk Herman. They're the ones who are putting out these new cigarettes, among the other names, Planet. And on the cover of the cigarette campaign, no additives, 100% tobacco. Well, three cheers for Mr. Butts. That's the name of the man who, on May 12, 1994, sent a package containing 4,000 pages of secret internal tobacco industry documents to the offices of Professor Stanton Glantz at the University of California, San Francisco. The return address said only Mr. Butts. The documents provide a shocking inside account of the activities of Brown and Williamson over 30 years. They're now collected in a book called The Cigarette Papers, and Larry Bensky is in the offices of Stanton Glantz at the University of California.
Dr. Glantz, here at your office, University of California in San Francisco, as I walk through these doors, I just had to think, where's the bronze plaque to commemorate the delivery of the cigarette papers 2 years ago, that now famous batch of documents that came to you? Am I, in fact, in the very room where this happened?
Well, actually, they arrived up the hall in our departmental mail room.
What was your reaction when you first saw them? Did you think they were authentic?
I didn't really think about the authenticity issue. Some of these papers had already been reported on in the New York Times and elsewhere, and I'd seen those reports a few days earlier. So when I first got the box, I just thought it was the same stuff that had been written about before without realizing it was much, much more material. And as I got into it, very quickly, I just realized these are just incredibly important and fascinating documents, because it really gave us our first comprehensive view inside the tobacco industry over a period of about 30 years, during which the whole modern debate over smoking evolved. And it was like an archaeologist finding a new tomb. I mean, it was just amazing. And I didn't really start thinking about the authenticity issue until later, when we actually started treating them as research documents. But in the end, Brown and Williamson sued the university trying to get the documents back and filed court papers swearing they were authentic. So that solved the authenticity problem for us.
Dr. Glantz, what do the documents say that you received? We all saw on television the corporate executives of the various tobacco companies swearing under oath that nicotine is not addictive.
Please consider yourself to be under oath.
Yes or no? Do you believe nicotine is not addictive?
I believe nicotine is not addictive. Cigarettes and nicotine clearly do not meet the classic definitions of addiction. There is no intoxication.
We'll take that as a no.
I believe that nicotine is not addictive. I do believe that nicotine is not addictive.
What do those documents, those thousands of documents, say?
Well, let me read you a couple of quotes. And again, I think the power of our book is we let the industry speak in its own words. This is from 1963, from Addison Yeaman, the vice president and general counsel of Brown and Williamson Tobacco. He says, "Moreover, nicotine is addictive. We are, then, in the business of selling nicotine, an addictive drug effective in the release of stress mechanisms." Here's a comment from one of their scientific studies, also from 1963. It says, there is increased evidence that nicotine is a key factor in controlling, through the central nervous system, a number of beneficial effects of tobacco smoke, including its action in the presence of stress situations. In addition, the nicotine appears to be intimately connected with the phenomena of tobacco habituation, tolerance, and addiction. So, I mean, we could use the whole hour up with me reading little vignettes from these documents, but they were very clear and very frank. I mean, the way the industry viewed nicotine back then was it was a desirable drug, people liked it, but the problem was that when you smoke something, which is a very effective way to deliver a drug, you got all these other poisons which were giving people cancer, and so... the question became, how do we deliver the nicotine and get the pharmacologic effect without giving people cancer? Now, this caused real public relations problems because they were claiming nicotine wasn't addictive and smoking didn't cause cancer. At the same time, they probably had the biggest research programs into how cigarettes caused cancer in the world.
Dr. Glantz, do you think that tobacco industry executives should be put in jail?
Yes.
For how long?
Well, I mean, they're mass murderers. I mean, the tobacco industry kills about 420,000 smokers and about 50,000 non-smokers a year. I think they've been guilty of the grossest kinds of misrepresentations to the public, to the courts, to the Congress, and they ought to be held accountable. I mean, they kill probably 30 or 40 times as many people as illegal drug dealers, and they ought to be treated the same way that the illegal drug dealers are treated.
What's happening to you and your research as a result of the political change in Washington? I know that some of your money for the work that you do comes through the National Cancer Institute.
Yes.
That is a federally funded organization whose budget is subject to congressional approval. You now have several powerful tobacco advocates in power in Congress. How has this affected the work that you're doing?
Well, it has made it a bit more difficult. And last year, the Republicans in the House directed the National Cancer Institute to terminate my funding. It was amazing. The NCI's budget is about $12 billion, and they cut my $200,000 grant for budgetary reasons, they said. But this is one where the good guys won. I mean, the National Cancer Institute really went to bat for me and stood up for the principle of scientific independence and peer review. The scientific community rallied. The American Cancer Society took a very strong position in support of my activities. And the net result was the grant is continuing, the work is continuing, and in fact, it's actually expanded a bit as of July. So the tobacco industry, which ran a very sophisticated public relations campaign against my research and against me, lost that round, because I think that's a case where the public health community did the right thing. And a lot of people viewed the attack on me as just the opening shot at a very broad attack on public health, and Congress was forced to back down.
Since this is an election show, can you tell us which Congress members it was that went after you and tried to take away your National Cancer Institute funding?
Well, the lead effort came from Congressman John Porter of Illinois, who is the chairman of the Appropriations Subcommittee that handles NCI. Although if you look at Porter's record on scientific issues and tobacco issues, he's actually pretty good. So my guess, based on absolutely no evidence whatsoever, is that he was getting pressure from elsewhere. Because I given John Porter's record, I just can't believe that the kind of outrageous attack on me that he ended up making was something that came from inside him. It would have been totally out of character. But, you know, Newt Gingrich is very good friends with tobacco. The Republican Party in general has really gotten in bed quite deeply with the tobacco industry, and who knows where it exactly came from. I think that the tobacco industry, and in fact, one part of our research looks at the political activity of the tobacco industry. They've gone from sort of supporting everybody to a much more partisan role, where they're much more strongly swinging behind the Republican Party than they historically have. Reynolds and Philip Morris are the two largest soft money contributors to the Republican Party. Bob Dole is very, very heavily involved with the tobacco industry. And So I think if the Republicans gain control of the White House and keep control of Congress, it's going to be a disaster for public health in this country for this and many other reasons. But I think if they don't, the Bill Clinton and the Democrats are realizing that the tobacco companies are not their friend. And it would be very interesting to see what kind of hearings we have if Henry Waxman ever ends up back in control in Congress. I'd probably take the red eye back just to watch. I think it'd be very entertaining.
I think you wouldn't be watching. I think you'd probably be called upon to testify.
Speaking of powerful political allies, the AMA came out with an unprecedented journal last summer, the Journal of the American Medical Association, on tobacco. Now, they had long been, and this may surprise some people, allies of the tobacco industry. Can you describe what's happening there?
Well, it's true. The AMA historically had been very closely allied with the tobacco industry, basically because they're both big, greedy special interests. But I think that because of the leadership of Jim Todd, who is their executive vice president, a group of people who at the time were medical residents and medical students within the AMA, George Lundberg and Drummond Rennie at JAMA, over the years, the AMA's position went from being pretty awful to being kind of okay. And when we submitted our papers that were published in the July JAMA last year to the AMA, the lawyers expressed a great deal of concern. And for the first time in the history of that organization, a publication decision at JAMA was taken to the Board of Trustees, who unanimously voted to take the legal risks and move things forward. And I've been told by people who were there that that act helped move the AMA forward. And I'm very proud of that. And I think that they are real heroes for stepping out on this issue, providing the first forum for our work, and standing up at a time that a lot of major news organizations were running and hiding under rocks. I have to say, though, that their largest state affiliate, the California Medical Association, is still in bed with the tobacco industry as they could be and has been the leader in the destruction of California's anti-tobacco program.
Speaking of publishing, you had trouble publishing the cigarette papers.
That's correct. Although I'm very happy with how it worked out, I had originally wanted to go to the University of California Press because I figured UC got sued because of these documents. They mounted the defense, and they ought to get the credit for publishing the book. But my other co-workers wanted to go with the trade publisher because they figured they'd do a better job of promoting the book. And I got one of the top agents in New York, literary agents, tried for 4 months to get us a publisher and just hit a brick wall of, I think, 30 or 40 major publishers turned the book down. And finally, I went to UC Press and they took it, which I'm very happy with.
They turned it down because?
Well, some of them didn't think it was a good book, which I believe they thought it was boring or too technical. But a bunch of them turned it down because they were chickens, because they were afraid they'd get sued by the cigarette companies.
And isn't the UC Press likely to get sued by the cigarette companies, or has the climate changed so much with what's happened in the last 6 months to a year about cigarettes and smoking?
Well, you'll have to ask Brown and Williamson. I mean, we think this book is accurate. We think it's a fair representation of these documents. We took great pains to do that. And if they sue us, they sue us. When they sued the University of California before, they lost. And maybe that will give them pause. But the getting back to the people who didn't publish it, I mean, I was told by a couple of editors that contacted us, this is the Pentagon Papers of Tobacco. This is just such an exciting book, you know. And 2 or 3 days later, I would get a call back saying, we're not doing it because of the lawyers. And I said, well, what about this is the Pentagon Papers of Tobacco. It's a terribly important book. And they said, well, what our lawyers said, if this was the Pentagon Papers, we'd publish them because that's just the Pentagon. This is the cigarette companies. And I was told that by several people. And when I was down in Michigan and met Mike Moore, the attorney general of Mississippi, who brought the first of the Medicaid suits, and he made his career as a prosecutor busting drug lords. And he had people come to him say, how dare you take on this? How do you have the courage to take on the cigarette companies? Because, after all, they're not just drug dealers, they're the cigarette companies.
Dr. Stanton Glantz, cardiologist at the University of California, San Francisco. He's also author of the book, The Cigarette Papers. Coming up in our last segment, we'll be continuing our conversation with Dr. Glantz. He'll talk about what the companies knew and when they knew it. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now!, the daily election program that puts the public interest back in public radio. I'm Amy Goodman. Coming up, we'll go to the second part of that interview with Dr. Stanton Glantz, the man who released the cigarette papers. But right now, more on cigarettes, presidential politics, and the media. Mother Jones Magazine has released an exposé of the cigarette industry, which reveals Big Tobacco's deep ties to the Republican Party, as well as the industry's strategy to defeat regulation, a strategy that includes intimidation and bribery. The special report documents the flow of money to Bob Dole. Mother Jones calls him Marlboro's man. Jeffrey Klein is the editor of Mother Jones Magazine. We asked him about the role of tobacco PACs in this election year.
It's a multi-tiered strategy. Tobacco has obviously had a bad couple of months, but they've had bad months before in their 100-year history of disinformation, fraud, and basically deceiving the American public. And they have a new strategy to come back. It consists of this. Number one, they want to win the presidency. If Dole is president, they will defund all federal scientists looking at, for example, the carcinogenic effects of secondhand smoke. And they will gut OSHA, they already have, they will gut the EPA, and they will say, Dole will say, I don't know whether nicotine's addictive or not, but I think it doesn't matter, best handled by the states.
How much money does tobacco pour into this, basically, war against humanity, and how do they do it?
Well, hundreds of millions of dollars, and it's extremely difficult to track. For example, in the soft money, you're over for some million, but as our articles show, they're giving to the governors, they're giving to the state legislatures, and we've uncovered phony grassroots groups in virtually every state we looked at. In some of them, there are $5 million enterprises, and others, there's $30 million enterprises.
Citizens Against Government Interference, names like that.
That's the Wichita Falls one. I like the one in Colorado particularly, which is Citizens Against Government Abuse and Tax Waste. And you look closer, and we found a $2.5 million check that went in to a bank that's laundered and then comes out to this committee. And overall, I believe they give $5 million. These look like grassroots organizations. And sometimes when we went to the filing forms, you'd see this sad thing where you'd get $750,000 from the Tobacco Institute, $375,000 from RJR, $600 from Philip Morris, and $10 from Lola, Hopkins. So Lola Hopkins probably wants to get government off her backs, but she's being turbocharged by $2 million of Tobacco Institute money.
Well, let's talk about the top man, Bob Dole, Senate Majority Leader, and maybe the next president, his connection to tobacco.
He has a longstanding connection to tobacco. I would say he's the most important tobacco player in the city precisely because he's not identified the way Bliley and Senator Helms are with it. He has a long history with them. There's two particular incidents which we detail in the magazine that are troubling. Number one, he is the legislator most responsible for the epidemic of smokeless tobacco, which is a euphemism for spit tobacco or chew tobacco. In 85, an excise tax was proposed that would raise the level of taxation on it to that of cigarettes. He defeated it. He slipped in a tobacco subsidy that Jesse Helms crafted. It continues to be an epidemic. I talked to Surgeon General, the former Surgeon General Novello. She said the main reason kids chew is because when they chew, it's cheaper, and kids are price sensitive. Chew tobacco, by the way, is far more addictive than cigarettes, and they move on to cigarettes anyway. Number two, and probably more important, is he was behind ramming open the doors in Asia for American cigarettes. And not only were American cigarettes put in there, we forced on those countries American marketing techniques. Previously, they had public health prohibitions, for example, on TV advertising. We have documents showing that he was personally responsible for opening up these markets. And as a result, let's take Korea, for example. Because of a deal that he negotiated, a year afterwards, Korean teenage boys rose from 18 to 30% who were smokers, and teenage girls from 2 to 9%. Very common. Asian girls didn't smoke before U.S. Marketing techniques went in there.
Well, you know, with all this information about Bob Dole, and I assume the Pacifica listeners, being the readers that they are, will want to get this issue of Mother Jones and read it for themselves so we don't have to dwell on all the details
right,
and put it into their heads. I'm more interested in the effects that this expose is going to have. Your cover story, Bob Dole and Big Tobacco's comeback strategy, and a great cartoon of him as Marlboro's man. What's happening here in Washington, Jeffrey, as you go around and being the media savvy person that you are, try to put this story in places that will not only get the word out, but call attention to Mother Jones? It's about Bob Dole. What are people saying to you? Are you able to get the kind of resonance you thought you'd get for it?
No. And my initial assessment of it is troubling. I probably need another week to see what filters through, but the initial reaction...
No pun intended about that filter.
Yeah. The initial
better
reaction...
Better than not filtering it.
...is that the reporters and the producers are quite excited about it. They said, okay, Dole, we need Dole news. And then something happens, and they come back to me, and they say, well, the Dole part of it is good, but it's sort of hard to tell on TV. What we're more interested in is in the fraud in Texas or in the fraud in Minnesota. Mind you, I'm glad to get any coverage, but they don't go to lunch with the people in Minnesota and the people in Texas. They go to lunch with the Dole people, and they're very hesitant to do it. I never said they should, go out and savage Dole. All I said to them, and these are big networks, is make Dole go on the record. Does he think, for example, nicotine is addictive? If he were elected, would he fire David Kessler? Does he have any regrets about jamming open these Asian markets? Is he sorry that he didn't raise the taxes on chew tobacco to the level of cigarettes? Fundamental questions, the number one public health issue of our time, and you can't get the Republican nominee on the record. Then I said, with all we've disclosed tons of his top advisors who are currently working for the tobacco companies. Go to Dole and ask him, did he know? Does he have any problems with this? We've disclosed that Philip Morris is sponsoring the two key events at the Republican National Convention. Ask him, is he sorry about this? I cannot, at this point, get the big networks to do that.
Considering you're not getting the coverage, let's talk about these senior advisors
yes.
to the Dole campaign who have close ties to the tobacco industry.
Well, we start off with Roderick Armont, and he's chairman of Lawyers for Dole. Last count was about 700 Lawyers for Dole. He's a former chief of staff. He'd have a big job in a Dole administration. What's troubling is he's from this firm of Covington & Burling, big, prestigious Washington firm. We discovered that Covington & Burling is sending around the country to attorneys general in various states a team to intimidate them. In Texas, we found that they threatened the attorney general there that if he joined this suit, they would smear him. They surveyed for him a push poll, which is a smear campaign. They were going to run against him.
This is Dan Morales.
Dan Morales. In Massachusetts and lots of other states, they threatened to clog up the courts forever. In a state considering filing, they said, nobody's kidding themselves that nicotine's not addictive, but we'll depose every Medicaid recipient in your state. This is from Roderick DeArmont's firm. He knows about this, I would assume. We can't get him on the record to say that. Is this the kind of lawyers that Dole wants working for him?
In fact, isn't the Covington and Burling partner who's going around a former attorney general?
They have with them Andy Miller, who's another attorney general from Virginia. And in each state they go to, they hire the biggest law firms. This is not on the legal or moral merits. This is simply, we can outmuscle you and make your life miserable. Next one, Steve Merksamer is very crucial. He's a key California strategist. And you get through him.
For Dole.
Yes, and general national advisor. You get from him a sense of what the real tobacco strategy is, which is far from wanting decentralized power, they want to send the issue down to the states and then have governors override it. They want governors to basically subvert what the people want. And
well, sure,
California,
it's easier to buy one governor than it is 435 congressmen.
Absolutely, and the press aren't watching. So Merksamer, who was a very bad guy in California, and his firm brokered the deal with the California Medical Association, which is now keeping the very tough anti-smoking commercials off the air. Merksamer is a key Dole advisor. We have Manafort, the guy who's running Dole's convention, is a big tobacco guy. He worked for Burson Marsteller. We have this
and
Tom,
represents Philip Morris.
Philip Morris. We have this Tom Collymore, who's a vice president for corporate affairs for Philip Morris. He's fundraising for Dole. What I said to the media today, and I'm despairing that they're going to follow on it, is I just found one vice president for corporate affairs at one firm. What's the RJR one doing? What's the Brown and Williamson one doing? I think Dole is surrounded at the highest levels by tobacco people, and it's certainly no accident.
One of the things you have in this Mother Jones issue, many, many pages about this scandal of tobacco, is the transcript of the ABC documentary, Tobacco Under Fire,
right. The
one that was not shown by ABC. And somehow you got a copy of it and you printed a transcript of it here, and I gather you've sent copies of the tape around and put it on the World Wide Web. Is that correct?
We put the, Paul Friedman yesterday, when he was confronted with this, said, oh, see, Mother Jones just ran.
Who's Paul Friedman?
He's the executive vice president of ABC. He said, oh, Mother Jones only ran excerpts from this show. If they had run the whole thing, people would see how boring it is. So in response to the Friedman test, I have now put the entire transcript up on our World Wide Web. If your listeners go to motherjones.com, they'll see this and they'll see clips from the show. We've also put up on the satellite the whole show, and we sent it out to TV critics to review.
Well, we can do better than that. We can play a little of it for them right
here.
One of the criticisms that ABC used is that the show was too boring to air.
Yeah.
What do you think we should listen to next to show how it's not actually very boring?
Fine, I'll tell you, but let me precede that by saying they own the show, they digitized it, they lawyered it, they cut it down to the excerpts that even they admit are newsworthy, and they've been sitting on admitted newsworthy segments for 2 years. My favorite is with Coop. Surgeon General Coop, a very admirable man, says on the tape that he was astounded to discover correspondence between R.J. Reynolds' CEO, I believe, and Ronald Reagan before the inauguration, in which Reagan admitted that he had more important things to do during his administration than pursue any tobacco regulation. And
okay,
Coop
well,
talks about how terrible that is.
Let's listen to that now.
There's a lot of money involved here. And you have to remember that the domestic future of the United States cigarette manufacturers is dismal.
Dr. C. Everett Koop was Ronald Reagan's Surgeon General and the most committed anti-smoking activist to ever hold the job.
This is a losing industry in this country. Eventually, we will have a smoke-free society here. And if that's the case, you've got to find some place to get rid of this tobacco. And so why not pick people that can't fight back?
Asia, home to nearly half the world's inhabitants. Its culture and traditions have survived unchanged for centuries. But beginning in 1986, a new wave of American culture washed over Asia.
Come to where the flavor is. Marlboro.
And the tobacco companies could not have done it without the direct help of President Ronald Reagan.
Before he was inaugurated, there was correspondence between the chief executive officer, R.J. Reynolds, and the president, calling attention to the fact that the tobacco company would hope that this president would not be too tough on the tobacco industry. And the president wrote back. I don't know who wrote the letter for him, but I could hardly believe it when I eventually read it. My administration will be too busy with more important things.
Not only did the president do nothing to hurt the major tobacco companies, Ronald Reagan, a former pitchman for Chesterfield cigarettes, actively helped them realize their long-range plans. 8 years ago, Reagan ordered the United States Trade Representative to, in effect, declare economic war on government-run tobacco monopolies in Asia. His main weapon, a presidential order, threatening huge tariffs on the exports of any nations the president believed discriminated against American tobacco. Beginning with Japan, our government fought for the tobacco industry's right not only to sell cigarettes, but to advertise them.
So ABC viewers didn't get a chance to see this.
Right. And there are other wonderful segments as well. There's hidden cameras where in the Marlboro van guy talks about how they're trying to hook young kids. There's a hidden camera in a smokers' rights group where the person who's leading it says, you can never say that I organized this.
Believe me, there's been extensive research on how to put these, how to get to you guys.
These meetings are designed to encourage individual smokers to speak out for tobacco interests. They preach about the civil rights of smokers. But the sign outside the room confirms whose interests are really at stake.
Politicians will not listen to you if they think all you are is a mouthpiece for the tobacco companies. Your only prayer is being independent, appearing independent, and for that reason, we don't get directly involved with organizing, you guys.
There's a really poignant segment in which a tobacco farmer says that, they need Kentucky farmers because we grow the best burley, and then the producer confronts him with his seed, his KY seed, that's been grown in Brazil at half the price, because tobacco farmers are the ultimate front group for tobacco. Ultimately, by the way, I believe in 20 years, tobacco will go off over, not just grow overseas and sell overseas, which is where their market is, but they will have their headquarters out of U.S. regulation.
You know, one of the most amazing things about the suppression of the ABC documentary and the flap about the 60 Minutes segment,
yeah,
which was suppressed for a while, is that tobacco doesn't advertise on television. It hasn't been able to since the 1960s. And people who make a kind of a mechanistic assumption, oh, well,
right,
the television networks are scared of their advertisers, and therefore,
right,
they'll suppress information. These people aren't advertisers.
Well, there's three reasons they're scared. First of all, they do advertise in Kraft and Miller. They have food products. And during the Philip Morris...
Because they're conglomerates.
Yes, and during...
So it's not the tobacco products that are advertised,
right,
on television.
And they have made threats that they would pull their Miller products or their Kraft products. Number two, they fear lawsuits. And in both of those instances, mergers were pending, and they wanted the mergers to go through cleanly. And number three, the sort of least remarked upon aspect, is the head of telecommunications regulation is Thomas Bliley, who's better known as the congressman for Philip Morris. And they don't want to make him angry because he can make their lives miserable.
Let me ask you about the governors. This,
yes,
operates at all different levels,
yes,
from the presidential candidates to the attorneys general to the governors and the state legislatures.
Yes.
What's happening with them?
Well, with the governors, we discovered something rather comic I alluded to. We found the governors meeting in Nashua, New Hampshire, where they were shaken down to by tobacco lobbyists to write letters to the FDA protesting the impending regulation of nicotine as a drug, and in exchange they were going to get cash, and if they didn't do this, they were going to be penalized. A North Dakota official told us exactly how this worked. So then we went into the FDA and pulled out the governor's letters. There's 700,000 letters that the tobacco companies have generated into the FDA, but we found six governor's letters. And they're written in identical language. It's really quite comic. If you go to our issue, you have things like that where they say, one of my favorites is from Mississippi. He says, "This insinuates that I and other members of Mississippi government cannot look out for the well-being of our children and that we therefore must rely on the paternal hand of our federal government. I resent the suggestion that Mississippi is unable to take care of its children." Okay, how about from Montana? "This statement implies that we here in Montana cannot look out for the well-being of our own children, and therefore we must rely on the assistance from the omnipresent federal government. Quite frankly, I resent this implication, and I firmly reject this unwarranted federal intrusion into our business." These are clearly tobacco industry drafted letters, in some cases just identical language. You get paid, you write the letter. That's the deal.
Jeffrey, let's talk about this election, because this is a show, at least in part, about electoral politics.
Yes.
What can we expect to see this fall in the 1996 election, both on the presidential level and on the congressional and local level, as far as the presence of big tobacco money? And what do they think they're buying?
They know what they're buying. And you're going to see them have 2 and 3 to 1 advantages in lots of races. This is very wealthy companies, $45 billion a year industry, and they know that politics, this is the single biggest political interest in the country. It's the most corrupt, and they're going to, again, turbocharge all these races, including the presidency, including the governor's races, including the representatives. They're going to make it so that their candidates have a very large advantage. You will not see the word tobacco mentioned if they can help it. Anytime they mention tobacco, they lose. So this will just look like the anti-tax movements are very robust, unless some enterprising reporters go into the filing forms, which are often filed too late, and say, "God, this wasn't Citizens, this was RJR.
Jeffrey Klein, editor of Mother Jones Magazine. The May-June edition is called Inside the Nicotine Network. You're listening to Democracy Now! Up next, the second part of our interview with Dr. Stanton Glantz, the man who released the cigarette papers. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now!, the election program where citizen action matters most. And there's one citizen who certainly took action. He is Dr. Stanton Glantz. He's at the University of California, San Francisco, a cardiologist, has been studying the detrimental effects of cigarettes for years. We're continuing our conversation with him. If you tuned in earlier, you heard the story of how on May 12th, 1994, he got a delivery of a box in it 4,000 pages of documents from Brown and Williamson delivered to him with the return address saying only Mr. Butts. Well, we may find out who that Mr. Butts is, but that has led to quite a story. And that story included Dr. Stanton Glantz putting these documents in the University of California, Berkeley, or San Francisco library. And I wanted to ask you, Dr. Stanton Glantz, we're joined by Larry Bensky, who is in the who is in your offices at University of California. I wanted to ask you about that turning over of the documents to the library. It seemed to make a difference in your court case that at this point, then, Brown and Williamson, by trying to get those documents, was stemming the free flow of information. Is that correct?
Well, I don't know that the premise of your question is correct. The reason I put them in the library was very simple. I have a very small office. It was a very large box, and people were literally tripping over the documents. And I realized these are very important papers, and they shouldn't be on the floor in my office. And it just seemed that the library was a more appropriate place to put them. What impact that had on the subsequent litigation, I don't know. I mean, from a PR point of view, having them in the library was probably a better thing. From the point of view of the university having the right to disseminate information to the public, I don't know that it would have made much difference, frankly.
As I've read your book, The Cigarette Papers, just published by University of California Press, it seems to me that to think about what you have in this book, you need to break it down really into three areas: medical, legal, and public relations. And of course, they all interact. The one I'd like to ask you about first is the medical one. It seems to me that it's been beyond dispute for at least 30 years now that cigarettes are addictive, that they cause cancer and other health problems, and that this is really beyond dispute. How did the cigarette industry manage to delay common acceptance of these conclusions?
Well, I think, again, I don't mean to be rude, but I disagree with the premise of your question. I think it's beyond dispute in the public side today that nicotine is addictive, that smoking causes cancer, heart disease, and other diseases. But back in the 1960s, there was still active discussion of these questions. Now, the public had generally accepted it, but people have a hard time putting themselves back 30 years when this issue was just emerging. I mean, I just turned 50, and I was still in high school then. So that was like ancient times, you know. But the fact is that because of the controversy about tobacco, and because of, in part, the public clamor to do something about it, in 1963, the United States formed the Surgeon General's Advisory Committee, which ultimately wrote what has come to be called the Surgeon General's Report, which came out in 1964. And
that's what I was referring to. That's okay. The one that nailed it down in my mind.
Right. But if you go back and actually read the Surgeon General's Report, it didn't say nicotine was addictive. It said nicotine was a habit. And the issue of addiction was debated very vigorously by the committee writing that report, and they at the time decided there wasn't enough evidence to say nicotine was addictive. And it wasn't until 25 years later, in 1988, that the Surgeon General finally issued a report saying nicotine was addictive. Well, meanwhile, in 1963, Brown and Williamson Tobacco and British American Tobacco had conducted extensive research into nicotine addiction and considered nicotine an addictive drug. We have their vice president and general counsel saying we're in the business of selling nicotine an addictive drug. We have extensive scientific documents from their laboratories on exactly why nicotine was addictive.
Now, how did they manage to keep that a secret?
Well, just to finish the answer, my guess is that had those documents been made available to the government, which the government had requested, the Surgeon General would have said nicotine is addictive back in 1964, and I think the whole history of this issue would be different. How did they keep these away from the public? Well, a couple ways. One is they just didn't give them out. The second was we've had governments for the last 30 years that really didn't take the tobacco problem all that seriously. I mean, Bill Clinton is the first president to really engage this issue, and the government didn't do the kind of things the government could do to pry these documents out of the tobacco companies. The public health community was simply not aggressive enough in dealing with the problem. So I think part of the way the industry got away with it was by simply not cooperating and by setting up a subterfuge to hide these documents behind their lawyers. And part of it was a failure of the government and a failure of the public health community to hold these guys accountable. Interestingly, back in 1963, the industry was expecting the public health authorities to squash them like a bug when the Surgeon General's report came out, but they didn't. And we've had death and destruction for an extra 30 years.
I remember interviewing somebody in the late 70s who wrote a book called The Politics of Cancer, Dr. Samuel Epstein,
yes,
University of Chicago. And he was citing at that point, I don't know if he was endorsing it, perhaps you can help me remember, the theory that it isn't that cancer causes smoking, but that cancer is an agent that predisposes people to smoke. In other words, cancer causes smoking rather than smoking causes cancer, that there's a genetic predisposition to cancer, and that then people pick up cigarettes and smoke as a reflex to their genetic background. This struck me at the time as bizarre. Was this something that really flew?
It's completely bizarre. I mean, and this is an example of the kind of bizarre explanations that you hear coming out of the tobacco industry. I mean, think about it. People's genetics evolved, you know, hundreds of millions of years ago. And the modern cigarette really was invented around 1900. And I mean, can you imagine that we all evolved out of the primordial ooze so that, you know, hundreds of millions of years later we would sell or we would want crave Marlboros? I mean, it's ridiculous, and it's the same kind of ridiculous pseudoscience that you see coming out of the tobacco companies in terms of their public relations and PR statements, which are designed to confuse the public and to keep people smoking and to keep people confused about secondhand smoke. The interesting thing, though, in reading the documents is you see how they set up the whole pseudoscience movement, and Epstein, by the way, is not one of the people whose name features in this. I just think he was thinking strange things when he said that. But they did have other people where they had a very orchestrated campaign to spread ideas like this, and it was all done very sub rosa. On the other hand, when you look at, and it was just junk science, when you look at their internal research, their work on nicotine pharmacology, their work trying to find the agents in cigarette smoke that cause cancer, was first rate. Absolutely first-rate work, and it's a real shame that they didn't make this available to the public, not only because the public would have been better informed, but also it would have really advanced the scientific issue very rapidly.
A number of attorneys general are now suing the tobacco industry for the millions of dollars that they say tobacco-related illnesses cost them in terms of Medicaid. Are they able to use your documents, the documents you received, in their lawsuits?
Well, they are definitely trying to use them. I mean, I was just met Mike Moore, the Attorney General of Mississippi, who brought the first of these suits the other day. A very impressive guy. And at the very least, the work that we have done has really educated and informed them as well as the judges that they're going to be in front of. And I think that our work is going to make it harder for the tobacco industry to keep these documents and other similar documents away from the courts and away from the public. You see, what they've done is they evolved a very sophisticated strategy where they would route their scientific documents through the legal department and then claim they were subject to attorney-client privilege. And they've gotten away with this for 40 years. Well, when the whole scam was laid out in our book, so that the attorneys and the judges could see it, it's helping, I think, to get judges to be much less willing to go along with these phony baloney arguments the tobacco industry raises. And in fact, one thing I was very pleased to see is that in a case completely unrelated to Brown and Williamson, I believe it was against Liggett, the courts refused to grant the claims of privilege that the tobacco company was making because of the information that we've provided showing how the attorney-client privilege and attorney-work product rules were being grossly abused by the tobacco industry.
Dr. Glantz, what do you think really should happen about tobacco in this country? What is a sane public health agenda? You dance around it a little bit from time to time in this book, but you never really come out and say what I think American society should do about smoking and tobacco is. What do you think should be done, and how do you get there in the present political system that we have?
Well, I think that we don't present an agenda because this is a book about these documents and the story that they tell, and I frankly think the book is stronger because we don't present a solution. We don't present an agenda.
Well, give us a scoop on Pacifica presented here.
Okay, well, I'll tell you what I would do, but I think it's important when we're talking about the book to really make the point. I mean, I made a very conscious decision to simply present the facts. Just lay these documents out and explain what they mean so the public can understand them without tying this to a specific set of proposals. I mean, to me, the solution to the tobacco epidemic is fairly straightforward, and I think we have a lot of the elements of it in place. One thing that we should do is we should continue the movement toward smoke-free environments. Clearly, and the documents bear this out, the single most important thing you can do to reduce tobacco consumption is to make workplaces and public places, schools and other places, smoke-free. Not only does this protect people from the thousands of toxins in secondhand smoke, but it also creates an environment that makes it easier for smokers to quit. And the best thing you could do for smokers is make workplaces smoke-free. That would be my top priority. I think the proposals that President Clinton and the FDA have put forward to regulate tobacco advertising and to try to make it harder for the industry to chase after kids are, with a few minor adjustments, a very good set of proposals that ought to be moved forward. I think the experience we have here in California and in Massachusetts and Arizona, where the voters have put in place aggressive anti-tobacco education programs with paid counter-advertising, have worked wonders. And we can beat the tobacco industry at its own game with an aggressive counter-promotion program. And I think that the litigation, particularly the Attorney General's suits to recover Medicaid costs, are a great idea, because I think the tobacco industry's been getting a free ride. And the taxpayer, people talk about the tobacco subsidy. The tobacco price support program to poor farmers is peanuts. The real tobacco subsidy is the fact that the taxpayers have to eat $60 or $70 billion a year in medical costs due to smoking. And if those costs could be internalized by the industry and the industry forced to bear them and integrated into their pricing system, that would be very, very helpful.
The other day, President Clinton, whom you've praised for his program, had his Operation Butts Out started in a high school in New Jersey. In the New York Times article about it, the reporter went to a young woman who was smoking just in outside the no-smoking zone of the high school. I don't know if you saw this. And the reporter asked her, well, do you know the president's in there talking about smoking and how you shouldn't smoke and you're a teenager? And she shrugged her shoulders and said something to the effect, cigarettes are addictive, I'm an addict. And she just kept smoking. Mm-hmm. How do you reach those people?
Well, I think you reach it by changing the social environment. I mean, the fact is nicotine is addictive, but as the tobacco industry is very fond of saying, 50 million smokers have quit. And, in fact, heroin addicts quit. Crack addicts quit. In fact, more heroin addicts and crack addicts quit than smokers do. But that's partially because the tobacco industry has been able to maintain a strong social network to support smoking and other forms of tobacco use. And I think as society changes, as people's attitudes towards smoking changes, largely motivated by the passive smoking issue, people will simply stop smoking. And some people will have a harder time than others. I think the one real danger I see at the current time doesn't really come from the tobacco industry. It comes from the public health community and the way they've been reacting to these changes. Because what's happened, and I think Clinton's efforts have inadvertently played into this, is the tobacco control community, rather than being focused on the broad issue of the tobacco industry, passive smoking, and the industry's marketing practices, have really come around to this idea of we want to keep kids from smoking cigarettes. And while I think that's a great motive, you definitely want to keep kids from smoking cigarettes, but by focusing so single-mindedly on kids, it's inadvertently playing into the industry's hands.
How's that?
Well, the tobacco industry sells tobacco by saying, and addicts kids by saying, if you want to look like a grown-up, smoke. If you want to be independent, smoke. If you want to rebel against authority, smoke. And to have the authority figures coming down and wagging their fingers at these kids and saying, we don't want kids to smoke, I think inadvertently reinforces the industry's message. I think we were doing much better two or three or four years ago when we were pursuing C. Everett Koop's ideal of a smoke-free society, which simply said that tobacco and those who sell it are simply not an acceptable part of adult or any society. Kids want to be adults. And to say we don't want kids to smoke is to, again, reinforce the industry's message that we want, if you want to let grown-ups smoke. And I think this has been, we've gotten into this pickle for a couple of reasons. I think one is that the FDA's proposals, which are centered on marketing, are by necessity centered on kids because that's what cigarette marketing goes after. And I think Clinton has realized that from a political point of view, focusing on kids is a good idea. I agree with him. But the problem is the rest of the public health community has just charged off around that position in a very single-minded way, motivated in part by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, which is a very wealthy but chicken foundation that is glommed onto kids as an uncontroversial thing to do. And I think it's having very, very bad effects on the overall tobacco control movement. For example, the Clinton administration a couple of years ago had several initiatives relating to tobacco underway. There was the FDA. OSHA was working on a smoke-free workplace rule, which probably will have more public health impact than the FDA regulations. The EPA was doing work on secondhand smoke. Well, OSHA is in the doldrums. The EPA has been told to stop working on secondhand smoke, and all of the eggs are being put in the kitty basket. And I think that the industry may well slide off the hook because of well-meaning but not very intelligent decisions being made in the public health community.
Last question. Have you met Mr. Butts, who sent you the box of Brown & Williamson documents?
Not to my knowledge.
Do you know who he is?
No.
Dr. Stanton Glantz, author of The Cigarette Papers. I'm Amy Goodman with Larry Bensky for Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!